All right, good morning, Council. I'll just make a few announcements before we get started this morning. As you can see, H-1-3-0-9-9-8 in the matter of the welfare of the children of DLW is our next matter today. Council, you're familiar with our procedures. You'll have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and the appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. Please state your name, identify your client, and let us know how we can reference you before you begin speaking this morning. And these matters are being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted. With that, Council, we're ready for you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Rhea Bornman Spears, and I'm here on behalf of Appellant Khadija Hardin. Myself and Eric Cardall's office have donated our time to bring this case before you for two reasons. One, for Ms. Hardin, and the second, because I have been an activist working for the last 10 plus years on child protection forms, specifically for Black families, because that's where I've seen the greatest need. That's Ms. Hardin. All right. In this case, Ms. Hardin is a licensed to adopt foster care provider in the state of Minnesota who has been denied the right to adopt her own grandchildren. Families like this one need a better definition for unreasonable when it comes to the county choosing not to place with her. There's an argument to be made that it should be per se unreasonable to not place with a licensed relative. That's the biggest point I want this court to take away from this, because we're using the Black's Law dictionary term of arduous, capricious. I mean, all the different synonyms are listed repeatedly in our orders at district court. And I believe that if you have a licensed relative and the state of Minnesota has said they can provide care, then we have so much research about the long-term outcomes and the emotional safety and well-being that a child feels when they are with a relative placement. And that can't be disregarded anymore by the child protective system. It continues to be disregarded because there's a way of doing things that's gone on for a long time. And honestly, in this case,
Council, I don't have any quibble with the position that you're taking today, but I question whether we're the appropriate forum as a district court or as a court of appeals to address the concerns that you're raising. They do seem like policy questions that should be or may be more appropriately addressed across the street with the Minnesota legislature. Do you want to address that?
Yes, Your Honor. So I have thought of that, obviously, you know, plenty of times. What do we do? How do we fix this? So this court, of course, has the authority to address reasonable's definition, and the reason that the district courts are using the Black's Law dictionary terms is because we don't have case law that says otherwise. So that's what they've started using amongst each other. So it's almost like it's being passed around the different counties. Okay, well, this is what I used here, and the judges are talking and whatnot. We don't have direction from you all about what unreasonable should be. And so that's why I'm saying that we need the district courts to get better direction. We need stronger direction because there are so many families that have to go through this litigation. And again, it just seems like common sense on the outside that if they're licensed and they're their relatives, the two should go together. But instead, we have these terms that can be interpreted by a district court judge and can make the array of decisions across the counties. I mean, it's amazing, because I was here not that many years ago for another case where we had in the same courtroom Judge Caligiuri, and she was finding a completely different outcome for the similar scenarios and same families than we had with our judge in this case, who this was her first trial for this kind of a case. So we have an opening, I would say, for you all to provide that for us. And I think that, that's one of the main reasons we were willing to donate our time towards this case. Besides, of course, the fact that it feels like such an injustice, for this family. I want you to know that facts you have read in the respondent's brief have been disproven at two trials, and yet they're still written and presented to this court in a way that, and of course, if you read them, they would indicate she shouldn't have a license, but she does because they aren't true.
Let me ask you this with regard to Judge Utley's order. Are there any facts in there that you think are clearly erroneous? The judge, I'm looking at page 27 of the order, and the judge indicates that she really struggled with making the decision, and she talked about unreasonable versus reasonable. So when I read, the facts seemed to be fairly thoroughly set forth in her order. It was a week-long trial with many, many exhibits and lots of testimony. So where are her factual findings clearly erroneous?
Well, I've got several answers for that that are sort of summary-like, so I apologize for that. But first of all, the proposed order, both sides submitted proposed orders, the county and myself, and she went with almost all of the language of the county attorney's proposed order. And so there's a way that you, I mean, you know, they say one side, the other side, and then there's the truth. So you can write things in a way that will make them sound much worse, of course, than they actually were, such as, you know, the child was injured on this date. Well, he jumped off a couch and got an injured ankle, but he was fine, right? There was no damage to him. I mean, it's not a removable offense to have a child jump off a couch in your care. And yet the fact is presented as if this was some significant indicator that Ms. Hardin was unsafe for the children. So things like that. So there are facts that are throughout there. I mean, even the facts presented in the brief, when you go through, right? I mean, we've already had two trials where we've had evidence to show she didn't disenroll the children. She didn't fail to have them get certain services. She took them to in-person school instead of online school. I mean, she got advice. She was also being approved by the social worker for these actions that then the new worker, Ms. Groh, came on and changed everything. So that's also very significant in this case, is that everything was fine. Everyone was saying she was doing a great job until the worker changed. And Ms. Groh was a significant factor for this case, and it was documented through her testimony, which I don't believe that the order reflects this, is that she was told multiple times to offer certain services, such as a PCA for Ms. Hardin, and she didn't. She kept making excuses throughout her testimony about why she didn't do it, despite multiple sources suggesting that was one of the ways she could have supported this placement. And then the documents reflect she went to make a PCA happen for the foster parents. So there was a significant, disproportionate treatment between the two families. And she, and you know, that brief references the fact that there was the parenting assessment that was done on Ms. Hardin. Again, the services that were recommended, the county wouldn't actually implement them. The supervisor herself of parenting time testified that she asked the county, would you like me to offer this service? And they said no. So it would have been convenient and efficient, and they could have made it happen. And instead, Ms. Groh made choices that would cause this placement to fail repeatedly, it seems.
So this is the piece that really caught my attention. I'm looking at page 22, paragraph 38.3.1. Ms. Hardin reported her fiancé, and as I read the record, she was, let's say, oblique about where the fiancé lived and what his past was. And then when it came out, reported that her fiancé would meet the children at some point and move into her home after the adoption was finalized, despite the fact that he is a convicted sex offender.
So that's an excellent point. That's probably the best thing that the county could hold on to. And let me tell you, they were all about it during the hearing, Googling and getting on their computers to find out information about him. But my client was very clear. And even during the trial, the judge also said, if she's indicated that she wouldn't choose this person over the children, then I'm not seeing that there's a lot of weight to this. But again, you have to remember the proposed order was written by the county, and the judge did not delete out all that information, even though the transcript shows she didn't find it particularly relevant. And also, we documented that there was evidence that, or sorry, no evidence, and we had Ms. Casey Burgum testify to this, that she had never before been in trouble for allowing anyone dangerous or unauthorized around the children. So she had no pattern that would indicate that this would be a problem. And also, Ms. Harden had a right to move on with her life, with the potential and the realization that she may never get her grandchildren back. So I believe that that's what she was doing. And then, of course, when she found out, or when the county found out, then she was caught with a dilemma of, you know, yes, half of me is considering what my life will look like without my grandchildren, but the other half of me says, if I get them, they're priority. They always have been. And there's nothing else. But of course, Ms. Harden also had a history of knowing this individual. She also knew about the details of his crime. And we all know that there are people who go through the criminal process that are convicted of things where it may not necessarily be the case, but they take a plea and whatnot rather than fight it because plea bargains, I mean, that's... So those are all things that she knew on her end of things that I think soften the relevance of that. But at the end of the day, most important, I mean, she went through all this work to fight for her grandchildren. She wasn't going to jeopardize it by that individual.
Let me ask you this then. It appears that you're contending that when a district court makes an adoptive placement decision between a relative and a non-relative, the relative's petition must be considered first, either in a separate order or at a separate hearing before a non-relative's petition may be considered. That's your argument?
So I don't know that it has to be a separate hearing, but it should be its own. You should be able to read the order as if it was its own. I mean, and the evaluation of the county's actions as if it was its own animal, in the sense that in Ms. Harden's case, she was licensed. She was the only parent one of the children had ever known. She had been there since, very early age for her grandson. All the people who had been in her home, just not the county workers of late, right? The prior one's fine, but Ms. Groh had said that she was doing a great job with them, talked about their emotional safety that they could witness, talked about them making progress with their goals. And then again, not significantly documented in the trial order, we have the experience of what the children were like once they were in foster care. I am not trying to disparage the foster parents. I do believe that they were doing everything that they could for these children, but it doesn't compensate for the fact that the children, you know, biologically feel emotional safety with their first primary giver and their relative, grandma. And so we had evidence that came out in trial to show how much they were struggling during their different therapies to actually accept the therapy because they were so emotionally dysregulated by their trauma. And we know that the department made a traumatic removal that was unwarranted. And we know that Ms. Harden's grandson started having seizures once he was told he was going to be removed again. And he's continued to have seizures. And we believe they're stress-related because it runs in the family. And he has been vocal at grandma's home about how he wants to stay with her. And we have all this evidence that came out in trial that just, you know, the order does not cover it. And that, again, that documents Ms. Harden's family life as compared with the research, which
did,
is...
Did you file a motion for a new trial to correct the findings?
No, I did not. So, and I don't believe it's required in child protection because we've got that 20-day appeal deadline. And so it's...
Expedited?
Yes.
Every which way?
Yes. And then obviously, as you mentioned, after a 7-day trial, I don't believe that strategically that would have played out in our favor. And so, yes, we did move directly for appeal on these issues and these concerns. I also want to point out, you know, along the lines of your question a moment ago, is that the APA with the foster parents being signed the same day as placement, of course, we learned that at trial. because discovery didn't reveal that clearly. So the same day, they signed a document telling DHS that these people could meet all the best interests of the children better than anyone else. And we know DHS, along with the counties, are supposed to follow the statutory and case law requirements that relatives are the most suitable placement that are to be evaluated first. So at the time they signed that APA agreement, Ms. Hardin was the best able to meet all of the best interest factors for the children because she knew their history, she'd been their primary, and she had that emotional connection, bond, attachment. She knew all their service history. And again, all those service providers too that came to this trial and the administrative trial testifying about how difficult it was to know that that removal happened when they had seen so much progress and love and emotional stability for these children, and the way the county ripped them out of the home, removed them from their school, changed everything, right? And then we've seen the traumatic results for the children. And then obviously minimized their contact with grandma, which we also just believe was part of their strategy to ensure that she wouldn't have as good of a case for an adoptive placement. But despite that, we had tons of supervised notes that show the children didn't get hurt there. At one point, the county was alleging she couldn't physically lift the kids. The supervised notes document that that wasn't true. There's all kinds of information in there, and even the supervisor testified about the, you know, that image of the grandson putting his head to grandma's and just saying, I want to be with you.
How do you get around us? I mean, that this is not a request for us to reweigh the evidence, which we can't do. So how what's your response?
Excellent question. So my response is that it was an abuse of discretion. The findings are clearly erroneous in that Ms. Hardin was not evaluated on her own right about how she could meet all of those best interest factors, and that she was a relative who was licensed and able to meet all of their needs.
And then how do you get around SG? I mean, how do you actually distinguish that? Because that seems to say, at least when you get to best interest, you know, it's a different statute, you know, different setting. Mm-hmm. But it's like, it's okay. If they do it, like, on this factor, Ms. Hardin weighs up here, you know, weighs here, and the foster parents are here, and then go to the next factor, and it kind of says that's okay.
Well, I would say that if we even look at the county's paper evaluation of those best interests, she was able to meet them all. And I would argue that there were factors that, again, were clearly erroneous in the ultimate order, you know, where she was able to meet the children's needs in ways that the foster parents weren't, including keeping all those community relationships alive and having them grow up culturally knowing where they come from and biologically knowing where they come from and having that piece of their identity that the research says is crucial to their long-term heart health, cancer risk, emotional health, not using drugs, not going to jail, having successful family lives. I mean, we know it's all the way into their, you know, the end of life factors for this. So, and I see I'm out of time.
Council, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you very much. Council, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Mary Lynch with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, representing Hennepin County Human Services, the Children and Family Services Department. We are here on review of an extensive district court order on a motion for adoptive placement. And it is our position, as articulated in the brief, that the district court did not commit an abuse of discretion. That is the standard. The district court is implementing a statute that has a very specific purpose and process. The district court is tasked with determining on a proper motion of adoptive placement, properly filed and properly supported procedurally. The district court determines first whether or not the department was unreasonable in making the adoptive placement that it made, and then has the option, has a variety of options if the court were to find the department was unreasonable. And among those is to do a best interest analysis of itself. The district court here found both that the department was not unreasonable and found that it was in the best interest of the children to be in placement with the foster parents at that time. The department So that's what we're looking at here today. That's what we're looking at in this order. That's what we're looking at in determining the permanency for these two children.
I mean, the advocacy here today is that when you have a relative who is licensed, that that it should be presumed that that is a reasonable placement. And so how do you respond to the advocacy that council is making, that that's how we should be interpreting reasonable, that that should be the default, that if you have a relative who's ready, willing, and able and has license to be an adoptive placement, that that's what the district court should do absent some reason
otherwise? I have all kinds of ways of responding to that with a negative, which I would get to if we have time. But also in this particular case, the district court clearly considered the value of appellant as a relative placement, understood that appellant was licensed to provide foster care and that that was sufficient to be an adoptive placement, and considered whether or not the department was unreasonable. And then again, did that separate best interest analysis of whether or not best interest required not placing with the foster parents and or placing with appellant. So I think the district court, so the statutory value is absolutely to place with relatives, and that happened in this case. That does not mean that the children stay with a relative when it's contrary to their best interests, and which is what the second part of the district court's analysis did effectively. And it also does not make a decision to not continue placement with a relative per se unreasonable. So I think that appellant, the SG and other cases have gone through this. Although it's not technically a preference in the sense that the district court has to say there's a preference and overrule it, that there is a strong statutory priority on placing with relatives, and the district court understood that and implemented it in this case. And both in determining whether or not the department was unreasonable and in looking at those best interests. So I think that's my primary response to the advocacy. I think the statute does present that really clearly. The department did live out that priority, right? The department placed with appellant first. The department continued the children with appellant despite accumulating concerns that actually went over multiple workers and interactions over time. The department attempted to engage with appellant to help appellant understand that these children had particular needs, they were highly active and required a particular type of parenting. The department provided the parenting assessment as a way to help identify if there were any additional services that might allow the appellant to parent.
How do you respond to what appellant argued, that the department didn't do enough? I mean, the district court here, I mean, in its order said that the way the children were removed, you know, was unnecessary and needlessly traumatic, and that there's a lot more the department could have done. So how do you respond to that?
In addition to that, opposing counsel says a PCA was offered to the adoptive parents and not to Ms. Harden. Those kinds of discrepancies.
So those were developed in the district court, credited. Even if that were accurate, I don't think it is necessarily. That does not make the department's decision unreasonable.
Why do you say it's not accurate? That kind of goes to the nub of it.
So there is testimony about the PCA that Ms. Harden was not in a position to take advantage of that, that there was discussions
with
her.
Was it offered? I mean, who? Did Ms. Groh offer that?
I don't.
Did she testify that she offered it?
She testified, I believe, and I'm not sure about this, Your Honor, I believe that she testified that she considered it and that she was not able to connect with appellant in a way that was able to make that referral. Ms. Groh did testify extensively to trying to help appellant understand the children's needs and get those needs met. Preschool environment, a proper daycare environment that appellant was not able or for whatever reason didn't take advantage of those services.
About help, like with transportation services? I mean, kind of the basic things that are done to facilitate taking care of two kids with special needs.
There was evidence in the record, and there was not a contention that the department was not helping provide those services and coordinate with appellant to get what the children needed. So I think those, to a certain extent, that was... that was not developed fully, very fully, at this particular evidentiary hearing, but there was also not a significant dispute about whether or not. There were disputes about the PCA that was developed, the department's position, and the response to it. The fact that the PCA services were not offered to the relatives, to the foster parents, until into the placement, and the foster parents themselves advocated for that. There's not information in the record that appellant advocated for the PCA as a way to address her issues with the children, partially because she didn't see that she had issues with the children. In the department, there is evidence in the record that the department tried repeatedly to help appellant understand that the department believed that she had issues with meeting the children's needs. And regarding the change in placement, it was abrupt. However, that does not render the whole decision unreasonable. It is not, it is abrupt, but it was also based on some really concrete safety concerns. There were statements made that led the department to have reasonable concerns about whether or not appellant would be able to safely provide for the care of the children in the intervening period of time. There was a decision to change the placement that was discussed with appellant and with an eye towards looking at a transition, but it was then appellant's statements during a final conversation about that, or I don't know if it's fine, right to say final, but during a conversation about that that led the department to have concerns that she would possibly leave, that she would possibly self-harm or harm the children. So, did that happen? No, but those were reasons to move the placement change into a more abrupt place than it was hoped to be. And there is testimony, I believe, in the record that the department hoped to have it be a more gradual, planful transition and change of placement. So, and again, even if it were, that does not per se render the department's decision to change that placement unreasonable. It's worth noting that the department did, because of that, sort of more abrupt, that change and undesired change of circumstances, the department did have the kids, the children in a, non-permanency placement, and then was looking for a placement that could also serve as a permanency placement. The department continued throughout to consider appellant, maintain that contact with appellant, both in the placement right after the change in placement and then in the placement where the children are now.
I believe one of the facts that was highlighted just a moment ago, and I think in the briefing, was that when the children were removed and placed with the foster parents, they also signed on the same day the adoptive placement agreement. Is that right?
I don't think, and I might have the timing wrong, but I believe that the children were actually, the change in placement happened, leaving appellant's home, and then the children, there was a search for a permanency placement, and then the children were moved into the placement with the current foster parents.
And the adoptive placement agreement was signed at the same time?
That is correct, yes.
That seems like establishing a foregone conclusion that the children are going to be not adopted by the relative, which seems contrary to the statute.
The contrary to the statute is this had happened, within a day of placement. The agency tried, the department tried over literally a period of years to establish appellant as the permanency placement and worked with appellant in hope that appellant would be the permanency placement. The department is charged with getting children into a non-reunification permanency placement as soon as possible. So planning, the department was very deliberately looking for a permanency placement. We're not comparing a parent to a foster parent. We're comparing two sets of foster parents.
My concern is that once the children are removed and placed in the non-relative foster placement, it seems as though the department immediately discounted the relative from potentially adopting the children. And I don't know that the statute allows for that immediate disqualification. At least that's what it looks like to me when I read this record.
So the children were moved out of appellant's home at the time the department was making that decision, looking for another permanent placement. The department absolutely had the duty at that point to look for permanency placement.
And I don't disagree with that, but I also, when there are deficiencies that are identified to the relative placement, where maybe the relative at the time the children are removed should have an opportunity to rectify those deficiencies. And it seems as though when the children are placed with the non-relative foster parent, that it is not allowing the relative placement to potentially change behavior or make some changes that would be of benefit to the children.
I think in this particular case, the agency tried to do that work before deciding to change the placement. Mm-hmm. The agency brought its concerns to appellant's attention and tried to make that be the non-reunification permanency placement.
And what's the duty of the agency once the children are removed, to the non-relative foster parent, once the children are removed from the
So the agency's duty is to the children, right? And the agency's duty is to continue to consider whether or not the children are being placed in a placement that is in their best interest. And the agency did that in this case by continuing. There's testimony in the record that I believe the trial court, the district court credited, that the agency continued to consider whether or not it would be better to have the children placed with appellant. That's what they did that a variety of times, including a process at which was reduced to paper, which appellant is, which counsel is referring to here today. But that was done coming up to the trial, right? The agency kept looking at whether or not it would be in the children's best interest to be placed with appellant, primarily because she was a relative, primarily because the children did have a relationship and continued to have a relationship with her. So the agency continued to consider whether or not it would be best for the children to be placed with appellant. I think that is the agency discharging its proper duty here.
Well, I've got a question. The issue that Judge Riley brought up about the fiancé's criminal conviction, the county didn't argue that at all in its brief. And so I'm curious, why not, and what relevance, if any, should we accord that piece of evidence?
I thought that it was just in terms of a tactic in the brief, I thought that I was responding to appellant's arguments in their brief, and that was not significantly in their brief, was not in their brief at all, I believe. I guess I'm not sure. I think it primarily went to appellant's credibility in terms of presenting herself as the person who was ready at the time of that hearing, at the time of her earlier motion for adoptive placement, as the person ready to be adopting these children and making all of the lifetime decisions for them going forward. So to that extent, it goes to her ability to safely parent the children, which was something that was part of the agency's primary issues at trial, the primary reasons why the agency sought to remove the children or move the placement for the children.
Okay.
So I think it's notable. I think it's a lack of regard for safety, you know, the planning and the decision-making regarding safety. But I think that issue was before the court, the district court, and the district court looked at it primarily from that lens.
But if she testified that if this creates an issue, you know, with regard to my suitability to adopt these children, then this person will not have any contact with the children and we will not live together, then what do we do with that?
Well, I think it wasn't, I mean, it goes to whether or not the department was unreasonable in its placing process. She hadn't even told the department about it. So in that sense, dealing with it at the trial at this process was, you know, notable again about it. If to the degree that which it is notable at all is, you know, her lack of full engagement with the agency about her ability to parent, about her safety decisions, you know, appreciating what were the appropriate factors to be looking at. And I think, you know, again, we're looking at whether or not the district court abused its discretion, and I think that element is not hugely dispositive either way. So I am out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you. I'll quickly start with the criminal portion that was just discussed and want to make the point that relationship began so late in the game of all of this that I do think that that also minimizes its value. So that was not something that was going on at the time that the department was, to our knowledge, considering Ms. Hardin as a placement. We were already set for trial long before.
So just be a little more clear. So the relationship was going on, but it was not factor,
so,
or the relationship just started late?
Yes, the second one.
Record show.
So what what happened is that the relationship started, I believe it was in the fall, maybe, before our spring trial. Honestly, I can't totally remember, but...
After the children had been removed.
Yes, years after the children had been removed. It has nothing to do with their decision to remove.
It raises in my mind the question of how it started if they weren't living in the same city and he was incarcerated, but that's probably outside the record also.
Well, it's because they knew each other from high school. So they knew each other, and he they ended up getting in touch while he was incarcerated. So it was always a hypothetical. Nothing ever actually happened that would endanger the children for the department to rely on. It was a hypothetical that maybe she would end up in a relationship with this person. But again, she said...
He was her fiancé?
Yes. So
they were in a relationship.
Yes, I'm not disputing that they were in a relationship. I'm just saying that whether or not they were actually going to live together or continue that relationship was a hypothetical. And yes, you and I may think fiance sounds very significant. And of course, I would question my client on that aspect, right? Just that they were engaged, but they hadn't seen each other in person, you know, for many number of years. So again, it happened quickly and it could have ended quickly. It was all a hypothetical that the county really tried to focus on and hang on to that was really only discovered by them during the trial. So there's no way they could argue that that was a basis to have made their decision against Ms. Harden when they didn't even know about it. Again, they wanted to use it to attack her credibility in the end, and it does make her look weak in that regard. But again, my justification is to explain that my client was trying to figure out what's my life going to look like if I lose, because that was obviously a very real consideration with how difficult and how long this case has drug on. So I want to throw that out there. Okay, I also want to tell the court remind the court that the best interests that were weighed with the foster parents and Ms. Harden, the foster parents had the benefit of 2 years because of this litigation. At the time the APA was signed, which is actually when we're talking about this unreasonable factor, Ms. Harden had all the reasons to meet the best interest factors, and these people who didn't know the children had none. So then by the time we get to trial, what the judge relies on is after 2 years of drug out litigation with this placement. So I would also add that. I want to also highlight that it was just said by a respondent that it spanned across different workers that there were problems with Ms. Harden's placement. That was not true. So a lot of the issues that Ms. Groh raised about Ms. Harden were things that the prior worker had okayed and let happen. So Ms. Harden is accused of unenrolling and choosing, again, she chose that in-person schooling for the children versus online. You've heard about their disabilities and what was going on with their age and development at that time. It's certainly not an unreasonable decision for her to think that they should go to in-person interaction rather than sit at a computer while she tries to keep their attention that way. And again, there was a social worker on the case who allowed that choice by Ms. Harden, and the parents still had their rights. The ALJ order highlights this too, that there were certain things that Ms. Harden was held accountable for by Ms. Groh that were actually not up to her. The parents still had their rights and had to sign off on certain forms to ensure that certain services were happening, and when they weren't reachable, when the social worker wasn't reachable, it became outside of Ms. Harden's control, yet Ms. Groh decided to lay that at her feet. And again, that ALJ order is so significant because the department learned from the process of that order that they had made wrong allegations against Ms. Harden to support their basis for not placing with her. Despite learning it through that process, they still continued to make the same arguments and to continue to be unreasonable. And I see I'm out of time again.
Thank you very much, counsel, both of you, for your submissions and your arguments today. They were very helpful to the court. We will take the matter under advisement. It has been submitted, and we'll issue an opinion in the statutory time period. Thank you.